They are elected by you, I am elected by you. I am constrained, as they are constrained, by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to be hosting this FedSoc forum called Legislative or Executive, the Curious Case of the Library of Congress. We're very pleased to welcome Professor Ann Joseph O'Connell, Professors V. Rosen, and Devin Watkins as our excellent panelists for this discussion. And special thanks to our moderator, Robert Rando, who is a partner at Patrick Doerr, where he brings over three decades of experience in intellectual property, complex commercial litigation, and appellate advocacy. His practice spans patent and trademark litigation, constitutional and administrative law, and high-stakes federal litigation across a wide spectrum of industries and technologies. If you would like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we will turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I will note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Mr. Rando, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much, Sarah. I'd also like to thank the Federalist Society for the opportunity to participate as a moderator in this discussion regarding the recent dismissal by President Trump of Carla Hayden, the Librarian of Congress, and Shira Perlmutter, the Register of Copyrights. These actions raise serious issues and fundamental questions about the scope of the president's removal authority and the constitutional status of these offices. Our distinguished panelists will discuss these issues regarding whether the president has the authority to fire the Librarian of Congress, and if so, from where the authority emanates. Likewise, whether the president has the authority to fire the Register of Copyrights. Whether the president can name an acting librarian under the Vacancies Act, and if not, whether the president has the inherent authority to name an acting librarian under Article 2. Also, the questions surrounding the current leadership at the Library of Congress and current practices at the Copyright Office. And are there any implications relevant to these issues that may be gleaned from the Supreme Court decisions in the patent cases Oil States versus Greens Energy concerning separation of powers between the executive and judicial branch with respect to the administrative procedures to invalidate patent claims at the USPTO PTAB, and Arthrex versus United States concerning the constitutionality of PTAB administrative patent judges, or APJs, as principal or inferior officers under the Appointments Clause, and time permitting, audience Q&A. Before we get to any of these issues, I would like to ask Z. Rosen to provide a relevant historical perspective on the Library of Congress and the Register of Copyrights. Mr. Rosen is an associate professor at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law, where he teaches courses in intellectual property, real property, business law, having previously taught at schools including the SIU Simmons Law School and the George Washington University School of Law. He has written exclusively on the history of copyright law in the U.S. He is a frequent commentator on contemporary copyright law issues as well, and has filed amicus briefs in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and U.S. Supreme Court. He holds a J.D. from the Northwestern University School of Law and an LLM in intellectual property from George Washington University School of Law. I should also mention that in 2015 to 2016, he was the Abraham L. Kamenstein Scholar in Residence at the U.S. Copyright Office, but has not worked there in a decade, and his opinions expressed here or in his personal capacity. Zvi, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Rob. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with the coelacanth. A fish paleontologist assumed had gone extinct 40 million years ago until they found a live one in the Indian Ocean. I think of a Library of Congress and a Copyright Office as constitutional coelacanths, living fossils still drawing air, and appropriations to this day. Whether a firing of Carla Hayden and Shira Perlmutter will allow this situation to continue remains to be seen. The Library of Congress has existed since the 18th century. Originally, it existed as a service to Congress, although there were glimmerings of its later grandeur earlier, most famously with its purchase of Thomas Jefferson's library following the burning of Congress in the War of 1812. In 1802, authority to appoint the Librarian of Congress was vested in the president, although regulations for the library would be made by Congress. Following the election of Andrew Jackson in 1828, the Librarian of Congress, George Waterston, who had been active in Whig politics, was removed from office, an action Henry Clay compared to the burning of a great library in Alexandria. Waterston maintained that his removal was illegal, but it was not undone. He was replaced by John Meehan, after Jackson's first choice, preferred a post as Navy agent for Pensacola. That choice might not hold up as well nowadays. Originally, copyright had no real relationship with a Library of Congress. Under the 1790-1831 Copyright Acts, registration of copyrights was handled by the clerks of U.S. district courts, who were often nepotism appointments of the judges, and who would keep the fees paid as salary. Following registration of the finished work would be deposited with the State Department in Washington. After Justice McLean's decision, when he wrote Circuit Scoville versus Tolens, a case involving patent medicine labels, the State Department issued a circular to clerks that patent labels for patent medicine should not be registered. How any of that worked, the executive department giving instructions to clerks of federal courts, I have no idea. The act establishing the Smithsonian Institution in 1844 added a provision that in addition to the copies sent to the State Department, copies were also to be sent to New Smithsonian and the Library of Congress. This is really the first time we see copyright being used as a part of a conscious tool to stockpile American creativity. And I would note copyright at the time did not apply to foreigners, so it was really for American creativity. The situation didn't last, though. The Smithsonian absolutely hated the situation. They said they were getting piles of useless stuff. The Library of Congress went along with it. In 1859, a law restoring the status quo and getting rid of copyright deposit outside the State Department, although it was moved to a patent office in the Interior Department. So during all of these times, Meehan, who you recall was a Jackson appointment, mostly acquiesced to these changes and didn't really advocate strongly one way or another. By 1861, the Cincinnati newspaper man Ainsworth Rance Bofford was referring to him as a very ancient fossil. Also, in 1861, Abraham Lincoln was appointed. As a Jackson ally, it was not surprising that Meehan would be on a chopping block. Lincoln fired Meehan and appointed John Stevenson to be a librarian and the same Spofford to be associate librarian. Stevenson was a doctor and was mostly busy with the Civil War. Spofford essentially ran the library, and Spofford became Librarian of Congress in 1864, a position he would hold until 1896. Now, Meehan accepted his removal of that complaint, so far as we can tell. Now, Spofford had a dream of a Library of Congress as a great national storehouse of American genius. And over his long tenure, he would be the chief architect of a transformation of a Library of Congress from a sleepy set of rooms in the Capitol to the institution we know it as today. Copyright would be a chosen instrument of this, and Spofford secured a series of reforms culminating in the 1870 Copyright Act, which moved all copyright business of both registration and deposit to the library. The task would prove enormous, with registrations surging in number under his tenure, and Spofford was, of course, busy running the library, and with the construction of what would become the Jefferson Building, the first freestanding building of the Library of Congress, and is probably Spofford's greatest accomplishment. By the 1890s, cracks were showing. There was some litigation over the Encyclopedia Britannica that showed Spofford backdating registrations. That in turn led to an audit which showed amateurish accounting practices, even by the standards of the 19th century. And Spofford urged the creation of a separate copyright agency with a director. Now, this was considered by Congress, but ultimately rejected. And they also considered a number of other appointment schemes before deciding register. And I will show you that's register, not registrar. would be appointed by the Librarian of Congress and would run a separate copyright office within the Library of Congress. Although I should say this 1897 Act creating the position of Register did not formally create a copyright office, it de facto did. Now, that same act clarified that the librarian would be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate and was subject to removal by the president. This led one senator to comment that the Library of Congress loses its, and I quote, loses its name and function of a congressional library and becomes a national or presidential library beyond the control of Congress, except by the president's consent. Now, in the first part of the 20th century, both the Library of Congress and the Copyright Office had leaders of long tenures, and a certain amity and informality persisted. There were questions of the authority of the Register of Copyrights to reject registrations, and in 1940, the D.C. Circuit held the Register of Copyrights lacked the power to reject works simply because of failure to comply to formalities, but had the power to reject registrations if they were uncopyrightable. So in recent decades, question of copyright for library and constitution have become more acute. The Copyright Royalty Board sets rates for statutory licenses. And in 2012, in the Intercollegiate Broadcasting case, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals found the structure of a board where the copyright royalty judges were appointed by the Librarian of Congress violated the Appointments Clause of the Constitution because they could not be removed. However, the court solved a problem by excising limitations on their removal, making them inferior officers instead. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998 provides for rulemaking done by the Copyright Office and ratified by the Librarian of Congress on exceptions to anti-circumvention provisions of 17 U.S.C. 1201, with rulemaking done on a triennial basis. This has been subject of a recent challenge by the American Medical Imaging Alliance, where that authority has mostly been upheld. The Copyright Claims Board, a small claims system established in 2020, has not yet been subject to a constitutional challenge, although it may yet come. It's thus somewhat surprising that this case may force the issue doesn't involve any of those, but instead involves a firing of Librarian of Congress of Register of Copyrights. In the early 1950s, conflicts over international copyright policy between the Librarian of Congress, Luther Evans, and Register of Copyrights, Sam Bass Warner, led to Warner resigning involuntarily. So far as I'm aware, this is the first time Register of Copyrights was pushed out. Now, some listeners may remember that in 2016, Register of Copyrights Maria Palante was much more publicly pushed out by the newly appointed Librarian of Congress, Carla Hayden. Following this, the House of Representatives passed Register of Copyrights Selection and Accountability Act of 2017, which would have provided that Register of Copyrights be nominated by a president from a list of candidates assembled by Congress and the librarian serving a 10-year term. This measure then went to the Senate, but didn't go further. The issue has been dormant since then. I should say I'm not aware of a president ever directly firing Register of Copyrights. Now, Carla Hayden had been appointed librarian following the lengthy tenure of James Billington, and his lengthy tenure had been convinced Congress to amend the law relating to appointment of librarian by for 10-year term for a librarian of Congress. In 2020, Shira Perlmutter became Register of Copyrights. She had been at the time in a senior position of a patent and trademark office, and she spent time both in industry and academia, and had spent early parts of her career at the Copyright Office. Although Hayden had been somewhat controversial among certain sectors of what might call the right wing, Perlmutter was largely acceptable to both sides of the copyright policy wars, making her firing something of a surprise. Now, it's rumored that Congress is going to make the Copyright Office an executive agency in some manner, while moving the Library of Congress more fully into Congress. I'm now excited to hear what our other panelists, who know far more about the constitutional issues than I do, have to say about the Constitution and what it says about this weird constitutional coelacanth. Thank you.
Thank you, Z, and I'm sure that we'll get back to ask you if past this prologue with respect to these issues. And now I'd like to turn to Devin Watkins for his deep dive into the issues before us. Devin Watkins is an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI, where he focuses on CEI's litigation and regulatory reform efforts. He has filed numerous briefs before the United States Supreme Court. He previously worked at the Cato Institute and as a senior software developer at Intel and WebMD. I like that. I've done that before. He earned a JD from the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Devin, you are now up.
Thank you very much. So this case concerning the firing of the librarian and the Register of Copyrights is one of a series of removal cases that are occurring right now that explore the meaning of executive power. The foundation of these cases is, where does the power of the president have to remove people from office? There's no explicit provision in the Constitution that gives the president this power. The president directly exercises the power to veto and issue pardons. But as to control the executive branch, there's no power of the president outside the power to remove officers. You may hear of executive orders, but a person, you know, official who violates those executive orders doesn't go to jail. The most that generally will happen is that they get removed from office. That is how the president exercises his control over the executive branch, is through the threat of removal. And that means that this is a critically important power to the scope of the power of the president. Starting in the first Congress, it was recognized that the president had the power to remove people like the Secretary of State from office under the Constitution. Any removal authority in the Constitution for the president must derive from Article II's vesting clause. That's the first clause of Article II that says the executive power is vested in the president of the United States. But then that raises a question. What does the executive power mean? What is its scope? And the Supreme Court has never fully answered this question, although it has provided hints or partial answers. The most complete definition that people argue generally falls within three categories. First, that the executive power means the control over the executive branch. That potentially means anyone who holds a position within the executive branch would be removable by the president. But independent organizations that might be established by Congress but are not part of the executive branch may be protected from removal. An example might be the United States Institute of Peace. And there is ongoing litigation right now over President Trump's removal of the directors of the Institute of Peace. The second is that executive power could mean control over those who execute the laws. And for this, some people think it means those people who hold positions that operate under the control of law, and that they are in some sense implementing those laws that can control their behavior. The president is, of course, charged by the Constitution to ensure that the law is faithfully executed. And those with this view think that it's not just a restriction on the president's authority, but also empowers him to ensure that all those people that are executing the laws actually faithfully do so. How else could he ensure that it was faithfully exercised? This is a powerful interpretation, but it is somewhat overbroad. It would cover even things like judges who operate under law that controls their behavior, that creates their office. There are also legislative offices like the clerk of the House or the Senate. So while this interpretation seems very powerful at first, it may be rather over-inclusive on what the president's power is. The third definition, and the one that I believe in, is that the executive power concerns the invocation of the sovereign power of the United States that is not legislative or judicial power. This is another way of looking at kind of the execution of the law. But under this view, you look at officers that are more internal or external positions. Positions that are internal to the government might advise other government officials or be able to block certain government actions, but they don't directly exercise sovereign power over the public. But the people who can actually arrest or prosecute or regulate or physically harm the public by invoking sovereign authority, those are the executive branch officials that have to be controlled by the president. So while the attorney general, also, for people who supervise such individuals, like the attorney general, who doesn't personally prosecute people, but oversees those who do. I believe this interpretation is consistent with Humphrey's executor, which said that the president has the power to remove those people who have executive power themselves, but not those who exercise other powers. And there are many agencies today that regulate the public, and I do believe are removable by the president under the Constitution, consistent with Humphrey's executor. And as an example of these views, I would point at James Madison in the first Congress, who thought that the president and Congress could not limit the president's removal of what is today the Secretary of State, but that the Congress could protect the Comptroller of the Treasury from removal. You have to kind of harmonize those two points of view and be able to see that there's different kinds of positions with different power. The Secretary of State invokes the sovereign authority of the United States in foreign relations. It oversees those who do likewise. Meanwhile, the Comptroller of the Treasury merely acted as a check on the Treasury Secretary. It was the Secretary of the Treasury that decided whether warrants should be issued, but then the Comptroller had to countersign those warrants. And so he operated as a check on that power, but could not directly invoke these executive power himself. The foundation of value of this third interpretation is the founders' belief in the importance of the people's natural rights to life, liberty, or property. Any officer of the government who could interfere with life or liberty or property had to be overseen by an elected official, in this case, the president. However, there were some officers who, providing a check on the government, could block such actions and help provide extra protection without themselves endangering life, liberty, or property. Now, let's turn to the Librarian of Congress and the Register of Copyrights. Some argue that the Librarian of Congress is outside the executive branch and therefore outside the president's control. In my view, that is irrelevant. Congress can't stick executive powers within an organization that's under congressional control and then allow itself to prosecute crimes or issue regulations. The real question is, are the powers of the registrar executive powers? And so you have to ask, are they invoking sovereign power? And I think they are. And does it impact the liberty or property rights of individuals? Now, as to the Register of Copyrights advice to Congress, that's not the kind of thing that falls within executive power. That kind of office can be protected from removal. But the Register also, in registering copyrights, takes actions that are incredibly important for private property and individual liberty. A copyright is effectively a government monopoly, like patents. Copyrights provide protection from the expression of an idea rather than the idea itself, but it's still a government-created monopoly. And that limits what people's liberty to publish similar works or to enforce those rights that they have for works that they've created. And so because those acts by the Register of Copyrights have the potential to really harm individuals' liberty or property interests, for instance, if they fail or refuse to give and register a copyright that should be registered, or if they register as a copyright things that are not copyrightable, both of those harm private individuals' rights. And so it's important that that kind of office is controlled by an elected official. Now, the Librarian of Congress themselves don't personally have any powers like that, but they do oversee the Register of Copyrights. And so because they have that supervisory role, like the Attorney General does over U.S. United States attorneys prosecuting people, the Librarian of Congress likewise must be controllable by the president. Congress could, as the proposed legislation proposes to do, separate from the Library of Congress from the Register of Copyrights, the Copyright Office. Then all of the Library of Congress could be protected from removal if Congress wants to do so. But Congress hasn't decided to do that. And until it does so, the Librarian of Congress and the Registrar must be removed by the president.
Thank you, Devin. I would ask you, you know, regarding the issue of that's raised in the oil states case in the patent space that was decided on the distinction between public rights and private rights. In the future, could that impact these decisions relevant to copyright authority?
I think it could, although it doesn't impact as much the removal questions, but the question of whether the copyright itself is a private right, and that is likely to be impacted by that. That decision allowed the government to kind of pull back the patents that had already been issued. And so these patents weren't private property that you were forever protected against. They're a government monopoly that the government has given to private individuals to help encourage them to create these new ideas. But it's under oil states, at least, that monopoly can be withdrawn so that people can go compete again if that is in the view of Congress or the government. I'm not sure oil states was correctly decided, but it is at least plausible.
Well, you and I are both in agreement on that. I think it wasn't correctly decided. I think that right to exclude should have been considered a private right. But that's the cause for another day. All right. Well, thank you, Devin. I would now like to invite Ann Joseph O'Connell to provide her deep dive into these issues. Ann is the Adelbert H. Sweet Professor of Law at Stanford University and a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. She was a presidentially appointed member of the Council of the Administrative Conference of the U.S., an independent federal entity dedicated to improving agency procedures from October 2022 to January 2025. Lord knows we need that. She is an elected fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the National Academy of Public Administration. She clerked for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg after working as a trial attorney for the U.S. Department of Justice's Federal Program Branch and clerking for Judge Stephen F. Williams of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, who wrote the decision in Intercollegiate Broadcasting, finding the librarian at the head of an executive department for selecting members of the Copyright Royalty Board. She has a PhD in political economy and government from Harvard University and a JD from Yale Law School. Anne, the floor is yours.
Thank you. And thank you for inviting me to be part of this panel. So I wanted to talk briefly about four issues, two constitutional and two statutory, and we'll do it as a bit of a constitutional sandwich. So we'll start and end with the constitutional questions. So the first question is whether the president can directly fire the Register of Copyrights. So this is a different question than can the president fire the Librarian of Congress? And I agree with Mr. Watkins that President Trump could have fired and did fire the librarian. Then I want to move to two quick statutory issues, whether the Federal Vacancies Reform Act of 1998 or the Vacancies Act applies to the Library of Congress. And here we can see the difference between a constitutional determination, can the president fire the head of the Library of Congress, and a statutory question, can the president use the Vacancies Act to get an acting Librarian of Congress. Move on to a second statutory issue, whether the Vacancies Act applies to firings. And then finally, finishing the sandwich back to a constitutional issue that has arisen not just in this case, but in a series of other lawsuits about if the Vacancies Act does not apply, whether the president has inherent authority under Article 2 to appoint acting officials. So I'll give my quick view on each of the four, but I'm actually going to give both sides of the arguments for each of the four issues. So the first issue, the constitutional one, can the president fire someone that the president does not select? So the traditional rule in constitutional law is that the power to remove follows the power to appoint. As the Supreme Court said in the Free Enterprise Fund decision, if Congress vests the appointment of an inferior office in a head of a department, quote, it is ordinarily the department head rather than the president who enjoys the power of removal. End quote. Now, of course, Congress can choose that default rule. As Mr. Rosen discussed, back in President Trump's first term, there was a House bill that would have allowed the president to remove the register with notice to Congress, but it didn't pass the Senate. So under this traditional power to remove follows the power to appoint, the president could not directly fire the Register of Copyrights. That's the view that I hold. Why else would we have free enterprise with the double for cause removal if the president could just swoop down? But the other side of the argument, this has come up in other litigation involving the Inter-America Foundation and the African Development Foundation. The argument the administration is making is a constitutional one. And the administration is arguing, well, ordinarily, yes, the power to remove follows the power to appoint. And that would mean that the Librarian of Congress could remove the Register of Copyrights, but there's now no Librarian of Congress. And so when that head of department position is vacant. The president, under Article 2, the administration claims, needs to be able to kind of reach down in order to execute Article 2 authority and fire the Register of Copyrights. So that's the first issue. Can the president fire an inferior officer that the president does not select? The second issue, a statutory one, is whether the Vacancies Act applies to the Library of Congress. Now, I agree that the president can fire the Librarian of Congress. That's a constitutional question that is, as Mr. Watkins describes, has something to do with the executive functions that the library has been assigned because of its copyright duties. And so you might think, well, if you think the president can fire the Librarian of Congress because of executive functions, that would make the Library of Congress executive and covered by the Vacancies Act. And this is where I differ. So I kind of hold on the constitutional. Yes, there's power. But on the statutory, I think Congress has more power, right? As Justice Scalia said in his Morrison dissent, he said, I am sure that Congress can divide up the government any way it wishes and employ what terminology it desires for non-constitutional purposes. For example, perhaps the statutory designation, this is the Sentencing Commission, that the commission is within the judicial branch, places it outside. I should say it wasn't Morrison, it was Mistretta, excuse me, is within the judicial branch, places it outside the coverage of certain laws which say they are inapplicable to that branch, such as the Freedom of Information Act, right? So Congress could exclude the Sentencing Commission from the Freedom of Information Act. And similarly, I believe that Congress has excluded the Library of Congress from the Vacancies Act, a statutory scheme. Now, what's the argument on the other side? Well, the Vacancies Act actually explicitly excludes the GAO, but it doesn't explicitly exclude the Library of Congress. It says it applies to an executive agency, including the executive office of the president and other than the GAO. And if you look at how an executive agency is defined, it's defined as an executive department, a government corporation, and an independent establishment. So the argument that is being made by the administration is that the Library of Congress constitutes an independent establishment, thus falls under the coverage of the Vacancies Act. I disagree with that, but that's the argument on the other side. The second statutory issue is whether the Vacancies Act applies to firings at all, right? Here we had President Trump firing both the Librarian of Congress and the Register of Copyrights. And the Vacancies Act applies when a previous office holder, quote, dies, resigns, or is otherwise unable to perform the functions and duties of the office. And the question is, in that textual ambiguity, whether that would cover firings. Interestingly, earlier versions of the Vacancies Act, we've had them since the 18th century, much like the Library of Congress, earlier versions said that it applied to death, resignation, sickness, or absence. So that would definitely exclude firings. But this broader language in the 1998 Act arguably could cover firings. My position is it does cover firings. You can take that text in the earlier versions and some limited statements in legislative history to say that it doesn't. And then finally, I'll just say a word or two about the second constitutional issue, is that let's assume the Vacancies Act does not apply to the Library of Congress. Does the president have inherent authority under Article 2 to name acting officials? So President Trump in his second term has argued that there is this inherent authority. Now, interestingly, there has been no claim about inherent authority to use the Vacancies Act since the 1998 Vacancies Act was enacted up until kind of this use of the Library of Congress. It's also been used for the Inter-America Foundation and the African Development Foundation. And here I believe this is maybe my strongest held position that the president does not have inherent authority under Article 2 to name acting officials. I would say on this issue, this has been litigated up through the D.C. Circuit. The district court in litigation involving the Inter-American Foundation issued a preliminary injunction saying on the merits, it was very likely that the president lacked this authority. There was the government asked for a stay of the preliminary injunction in the D.C. Circuit. They did not get the stay. It was a 2-1 decision. Now, what's interesting is Judge Rao was in dissent. She believed there should be a stay, but not on this issue. So even a Judge Rao on this issue said that she did not believe that there was inherent authority under Article 2. She said, quote, "The text and structure of the Constitution strongly suggests that the president has no inherent authority to appoint officers of the United States like IAF board members outside the strictures of the Appointments Clause." And as the district court judge said, kind of what would be the point of the recess Appointments Clause if the president could use inherent authority under Article 2? Now, what's the argument on the other side? This one's harder for me because of my strongly held position. But what the government is arguing is that it would be for a temporary amount of time that the president under Article 2 needs to be able to exercise his take care duties, and to do that needs to have people in place while the appointments process churns. But that argument has yet to get any adopters in the courts. Thank you.
And I realized I should have said in my part what you alluded to, which is that the president has named an act, Todd Blanche from DOJ to be the acting librarian, and Paul Perkins from DOJ to be the acting register of copyrights. So far as I know, Todd Blanche has not, and Paul Perkins arrived there on the day they were named and have not returned. And currently the deputy librarian is de facto, I think, the acting as librarian, while the Copyright Office is doing its best to serve an ad hoc arrangement. I will note that Carla Hayden is still on the website, I believe, as Librarian of Congress. No, I was wrong, that hasn't been updated. But Shira Perlmutter was on the Library of Congress, the Copyright Office website, for quite a while afterwards. And not sure if she still is. So, bit of a quagmire there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see in her lawsuit, Perlmutter's lawsuit, what claims she raises. So she doesn't challenge presidential removal of the Librarian of Congress, right? She doesn't challenge the firing of the librarian. She does challenge her firing, and she also makes these Vacancies Act arguments.
I just checked. Cheryl Perlmutter is still on the Library the Copyright Office website as Register of Copyrights.
Well, Zvi, you actually anticipated my question. I was about to ask about addressing the current state of affairs, but I guess you just have. A question occurs to me: where would the authority lie to appoint someone if the president doesn't have that authority to appoint an acting?
Well, sometimes we have no one, right? So the Merit Systems Protection Board, as a multi-member headed agency, is explicitly excluded from the Federal Vacancies Reform Act. It lacked a quorum for many years, resulting both like through the Trump first administration and also through many years of the Biden administration. And there was a backlog of over 3,500 cases. Now, I do think that this administration, it hasn't done it yet, but I think their argument would extend to saying, if we don't have a quorum in independent regulatory commissions and boards, we, outside of the Vacancies Act, through inherent Article 2, can appoint acting commissioners and board members. I don't know if it's coming. I don't think it's going to be successful as a constitutional argument, given, unlike removal, right? There's removal and there's appointment. And when it comes to appointment, there's a bunch more in the Constitution there, right? There's the Appointments Clause and there's a Recess Appointments Clause, whereas removal is maybe an easier argument, and also under this court, a kind of easier argument to make about presidential power. But it's hard to make that same presidential power argument in the face of constitutional text about the Recess Appointments Clause. Like, why have it?
Yeah, just as a practical matter, it seems to me, and if you were to consider this in the context of DOGE, right? If a commission is essentially not functioning, Can an argument be made that either it's not necessary, or if it is necessary, that that's where the inherent power would kick in, so that you have a functioning entity? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I could imagine, and there is some dicta in a case called Williams decades ago in the District Court of D.C. You could imagine an emergency situation where it is so close to presidential power. Imagine we're in a wartime situation, and let's just imagine it's not true. It turns out that, you know, Defense Department is covered by the Vacancies Act, but imagine it wasn't, right? And something happens to the Secretary of Defense, and you just immediately need to, like an emergency exception, need to get someone in, to get someone in outside of any kind of statutory scheme. But I think here, like in the situations that have happened with the Librarian of Congress, the Inter-America Foundation, or the African Development Foundation, the White House has created the emergency in the sense, right, of firing people. So I would actually allow, I mean, people would disagree, like I might allow an emergency exception for inherent authority for appointing temporary officials, but not when the White House has created that situation. And I'm not entirely sure what the scope, and I still think the recess appointments clause in an emergency could get you a...
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely possible that Congress could just adjourn, sign, die, and let the president appoint whoever he wants. That would be perfectly constitutional. But that is the only kind of acting official that I see the Constitution authorizing the president to appoint, even in the case of an emergency. The Congress is available to confirm anyone in the case of an emergency. And if they're not, they're adjourn, sign, die, and he can appoint them on the recess appointment clause. So it's always available to be able to appoint people if it's needed. As it applies to the Vacancies Act, I think it's a close question whether the Vacancies Act applies to the Library of Congress. It's definitely possible for the Congress to kind of separate things and say the Library of Congress is in the legislative branch and that this only applies to the executive branch. And it may have a different definition of those terms than what the Constitution says. And so I think it's a close call whether it's an executive agency. I think you can definitely make arguments both ways. I don't think the Vacancy Act applies to firing. When the Vacancy Act says otherwise unable to perform the functions and duties of the office, I think that is similar to the first part of that series as someone who dies or resigns. This is someone who the office has become vacant, not because of any presidential action, but because of some external effect that has caused this office to become vacant. That's the kind of uncontroversial time period in which we can have these kind of temporary appointments where the Senate doesn't may not feel it needs to be involved. We can kind of presume that when we're interpreting this language. But when the president comes in and fires someone because they think they were doing it badly or they think that it should be done differently, that's the kind of situation where the Senate definitely wants to be involved in who their replacement is and what they're going to be doing and how that office is going to change from the person that they had confirmed. So I can't imagine the Senate trying giving up that kind of power and allowing the president to select whoever he wants and replace them at will.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I understand that, and that's the whole advice and consent role, right? And I guess there are a couple of issues here that really create the problem or these questions. And that's, if we had an efficiently functioning Congress, we might not be having this conversation. And on top of that, or beside that, or in addition to that, we live in the reality of politics have been interjected into everything that occurs in D.C. So maybe it's always been there, but, it's quite prevalent. I would ask each or any of you, what are the broader implications or potential impact consequences beyond the library and the Copyright Office regarding other agencies and governmental entities? And I throw that open to anyone, and if you have any thoughts,
Well, the Vacancies Act at least applies to almost all federal agencies in some way, and it's been used in a variety of times, including by President Trump. I believe President Trump tried to use the Vacancy Act to appoint and put Ken Cuccinelli as a acting official during his first term, and that was challenged in court. And so I think there's a lot of different aspects of the Vacancy Act that applies to a variety of agencies throughout the government.
I guess I would say, it's complicated. So we have a huge group, like bipartisan group, members of Congress, good governance organizations, scholars and commentators who think that there are too many Senate-confirmed positions. Now, obviously, you need to have advice and consent for principal offices, but for inferior offices, Congress can choose one of three alternatives: the president alone, a head of a department, a court of law, and let's kind of bracket whether there are constitutional issues with the court of law appointing inferior executive officers, as Justice Thomas mentioned in a footnote in his Braidwood dissent. But in all three of those alternatives, Congress gives up power. So it's really hard politically for Congress to give up power and cut Senate confirmed slots. Like the last time they did it was in 2012 for about 160 positions. And we've kind of have it grown up since then, because the idea of it's, well, it's important, it's a crisis, or because of politics, right? The CDC director did not used to be a Senate confirmed position. And starting in January 2025, the CDC director is now a Senate confirmed position because of the kind of politics that evolved after the pandemic. And so I think many people think we have too many of these positions. On the other hand, these same people think that the Vacancies Act is too broad. Like you can really swoop in and do things. It's written kind of poorly in parts, definitely needs to be amended to clarify some of the ambiguities, say presidential removal, et cetera. But in essence, the Vacancies Act is doing what Congress won't do formally. Is the Vacancies Act for long periods of time is allowing non-confirmed people to serve temporarily in a bunch of positions. So it is, in essence, cutting the number of Senate confirmed positions. Not quite exactly how the framers wanted it to work, but in practice, it's doing that. And so I think the Congress could get together, come up with a list and cut positions. I will say this, is that we have a traditional appointments process. It's broken. It's broken for Democrats. It's broken for Republicans. Takes too long to nominate, takes too long to confirm. There are all these procedural hurdles that the opposite side kind of brings up. It's like equal side offensive. But the Vacancies Act is a huge workaround to the traditional appointments process. So actings look really attractive. But then what we haven't talked about at all is that there's a big workaround to the Vacancies Act. Like you don't qualify for the Vacancies Act, or the time limits have run out. You can just, in many cases, delegate non-exclusive functions of the job downward. And so the Vacancies Act is a workaround to the appointments process, and delegation is a huge workaround to the Vacancies Act. And I mean, I feel like that's where we should really be talking when things are getting conducted via delegation. I mean, right now, FEMA is being run through delegation, not through acting officials, through delegation.
I think there's a real problem with that, because under the Constitution, my understanding at least, is that it creates these officers of the United States that have specific requirements for appointments. And, you know, some of these inferior officers that are being delegated are officers of the United States that are properly commissioned as officers of the United States. But other times they delegate to people who are not officers of the United States. And when that occurs, that violates the Constitution, in my opinion. You got to be an officer of the United States before you can exercise sovereign power, even if it's been delegated to you.
Yeah. For the cabinet departments, it gets easier for an administration because they have housekeeping statutes, which allow them to create, in essence, like Congress has given them power to create offices, if that makes sense. Now, your argument might be Congress has to kind of specifically create each office. But at least for the cabinet departments, there are statutes that allow them, in essence, to create inferior offices.
You know, that point that you raise, also brings up the issue that was confronting the Supreme Court in Arthrex regarding principal versus inferior officers in the patent space. And not that the Supreme Court clarified anything about the distinction, but the way the court handled it was, as long as there's a principal officer that's been appointed through the appointments clause that can have the final word, so to speak, or control over the APJs and their decision by review, then that would be okay. But I think your point, Devin, regarding inferior officers exercising that kind of control, I see it as a constitutional violation. And again, the case law, the Supreme Court has, it's so murky that they're trying to define principal and inferior. So that doesn't really help the cause.
No, I think it's pretty, they've come to a much more consistent interpretation recently. Principal officers are those officers that don't have a superior. Their only superior is the President of the United States. That seems to be the definition of the court these days. And so.
That was not the definition that they laid out in Braidwood, right? The latest decision we've had is not Arthrex, but is Braidwood about the constitutionality of the Preventative Services Task Force.
Yeah.
There we had a 6-3 decision that the Preventative Services Task Force members were inferior officers. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting that the two components that they focused on was not actually who the supervisor is. The first component they focused on was removability, which is interesting to this discussion. And mm-hmm. the second was about kind of what control someone other than them has about their decisions. It was kind of a convoluted interpretation of the statute, in my opinion, to argue that the Secretary of Health and Human Services can not enact grade A and grade B services at no cost, mandate that through insurers.
Yeah, but in some ways that is a kind of supervision.
Yeah. But they didn't focus on this kind of other than the president language. It was more, almost interestingly enough, kind of function, like it was both, it's an interesting opinion as someone who sort of teaches that it has both formalist and functionalist elements.
You had raised the issue. The way I see it, the Constitution provides from the top down, appointments, but then you raise the issue that from the bottom up, depending on what the functions are, that's creating this, more and more appointments going through that process. Go ahead, Devin.
I want to say, like, those officers that don't have a superior, whose superior is only the President of the United States, those are principal officers. But there may be people that are principal officers who also have a superior that are lower level. And I'm not sure they fully clarified that as well.
Sure.
I think it matters for actings. Was Matthew Whitaker constitutionally serving? He was unconfirmed as acting attorney general in President Trump's first term. And so this direction and supervision by someone other than the president, there's actually a word right before that test, which is, kind of like generally, typically, that's true. And the Supreme Court has reiterated the Eaton case, which says that someone serving temporarily in a principal office is an inferior officer. Mm-hmm. And the question is, and I think there's an originalist defense of that, like we allowed in 1795 kind of 6-month service of non-confirmed people in principal offices. So I don't think you always have to have a supervisor, but I think there are kind of other constraints there about kind of what makes a principal office versus an inferior office.
Yes.
And at least for now, we have this weird thing that you can have things that are principal offices filled by inferior officers, at least temporarily.
And I don't think they've really grappled with the time limitation, because if you allow temporary officers for 6 months, what about a year? What about 5 years? What about the rest of your life? Does it become too long?
So for those who are listening, this is, I think, a really interesting constitutional issue. And Judge Thapper on the Sixth Circuit in a decision called ROP, R-O-P versus the Federal Housing Finance Agency, kind of wrestles in this and a kind of he's concurring in part and dissenting in part. It was involved kind of a really long acting service at the FHFA. And he talks both about these kind of an originalist take about how we figure out these time limits. And he kind of assesses like what the outer time limit might be. Although I have a broader view, I'm more of a functionalist than a formalist. I'm not an originalist. if I were to predict where the court is going on acting service, I think that Judge Thapar's opinion in that case is a good predictor about where the court might end up.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, again, my next question was anticipated. Getting back to the issues regarding the library and the Copyright Office, I'm interested to know where each of you think things may ultimately end up.
Start with the copyright expert.
Yeah, so I'll jump in. I mean, there seems to be a strong head of wind. My impression was, if not for the House's early close of a session, they would have recessed. They would have introduced this bill. It seemed to have a good head of steam and be kind of negotiated at least partially already. Now, there's issues there. I mean, and I think a lot of discussion we were having about the benefits of confirmed versus unconfirmed people is going to play out at the Copyright Office. There's a long history of subject matter experts no one outside of corporate world has heard of running the Copyright Office, and that's generally worked fairly well, although not everyone agrees with that. If you start having it be Senate confirmed, it may change the tenor of the office. Like some people may prefer that, but it's going to be a change. I have to think that's going to happen, and then probably we'll see the Library of Congress go back more into the legislative branch.
My view, there's probably going to be fights over whether these registrations that have occurred without a registrar are valid. I don't think they're valid, but that litigation is going to take a long time to work its way through the courts. And my guess is in about about 6 or 8 months, we'll have a new person that's been nominated and being confirmed to be the librarian to Congress. They'll appoint a new registrar. That registrar will go back over all the registrations that were issued, and they will sign them and reissue them, and then it'll all be moot.
I think it's a procedure. I think in the past there's been a ratification where people have suggested that of ratifying registrations as well. I think that's probably right.
I don't think that works, at least under the Vacancies Act. Vacancies Act is very clear that if the current temporary appointment of the Librarian of Congress is invalid under the Vacancies Act, you cannot ratify the actions that occur.
Well, here's a thought. In light of the Supreme Court decision that is, in terms of enforcement of copyright, as long as you've applied for it, right, you can bring an action. Does that play into it at all?
It could. I mean, there's going to be cases where someone violates someone's copyright. They go down to the register office. They register the copyright. They then try to file a lawsuit based on that registration. The other person goes to defense. Nope, that's not a valid registration. And my guess is they're going to fight about that for a long time. And eventually we're going to have a registrar. But we might have a decision for those registrations issued in that very temporary window before a new registrar gets confirmed.
I should comment.
Librarian gets confirmed.
That's a Fourth Estate case, which held that you cannot bring a suit until registration is either completed or rejected. And yeah, of course, that's a question. Clearly, if they're not rejected and if they're not registered either, then you can't bring suit. So I agree.
Okay. Well, we're almost at time. Any final thoughts? Well, I'll ask. Let's start with Professor O'Connell.
Ooh, I'm not a copyright expert, but I remember talking to Judge Williams after the intercollegiate broadcasting and I was kind of teasing him a bit because I was like, it's the Library of Congress. So how could it be an executive department? It's a very functionalist opinion. But I do think this goes back to what Mr. Watkins was discussing. And where Mr. Rosen started about kind of the library is an odd entity. I wrote a piece years ago called Bureaucracy at the Boundary. And I think that Congress is going to have some tough choices, right? If it wants stuff to be its, right? Like if it wants stuff to be protected, maybe the Congressional Research Service confidential requests going in to CRS, then maybe it's going to need to carve out the copyright functions, because they do seem quite executive to me.
Thank you. Devin, final thoughts?
The executive branch has been pushing the envelope of the Vacancies Act more and more. And as it does so, it gets further away from the core of what the Vacancy Act clearly authorizes. And I think it's only a matter of time until they're going to get bit on that in one of these cases.
Thank you, Devin. And three, we've come full circle. You began it. You can end it.
It's so fascinating. As someone who really always says I don't do con law, I seem to end up in Miss Briar Patch more than I think. And it's so wonderful to hear from these expertise people who do know much more about con law than I do about this issue, which is really, I mean, 7% of U.S. exports are copyright. And this is not a small question. And so it's good to get expert opinions about how to fix this, what's going on.
Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Federalist Society, and thank you to all the folks that in the audience.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Professor O'Connell, Professor Rosen, and Mr. Watkins for speaking with us today, and to Mr. Rando for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, bedstock.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.